From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're talking about war, rebuilding, and Hollywood.
The children of Europe will die in greater numbers than in the war, unless we immediately undertake her economic recovery. With the Marshall Plan, we will be the first great nation in all the history of the world to feed and support our former enemies as well as our friends.
The war in Iraq is winding down, and the hot talk of lightning thrusts and military might is giving way to words of aftermath and reconstruction, of building roads, of rebuilding politics, of emotional recovery. It's already clear that Iraq's path and America's will be long, expensive, and incredibly complex. Like the aftermath of most wars, only maybe more so. We've heard from the White House and the Pentagon, from NGOs, economists, and even psychiatrists. Tonight we're turning to Hollywood and its long history of weighing war's aftermath in rebuilding and restoration, in the recovery of whole societies and of single lost souls. What movies of war's aftermath speak to you and to the challenges now in Iraq and in America? What will Hollywood's storyline, America's storyline, ultimately be for this war and its aftermath? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, a film critic and artistic director at the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Garen. Good to see you.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello up there, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Garen.
Hey, Jack.
So here we are. We've got a real life, flesh and blood and woe and hope, reconstruction, rebuilding in front of us right now in Iraq. The last week has been kind of an astonishing turn from all the flush of we did it, it's done that you heard around the United States to the realization that, oh, my gosh, this is a huge task in front of us and one that we may not even be welcome in carrying out. As we sat around this week talking about it, we thought, and I know you kicked right in here, Garen, that Hollywood has been down this road many times, for better and for worse. But there's a lot of perspective wrapped up in those canisters of film, and we thought we'd look at them tonight. What's the general vista here, if you look at how Hollywood treats the aftermath of war, gear?
Usually what they do is they try and make it personal, because obviously with Hollywood, making a personal statement means an individual story, and you see the society reflected through the individual. What's interesting in that our opening clip with Truman, the HBO film from 1995, is we get to see Truman as the individual. This is something that was based on the McCulloch book, and he took this, again, on a personal level, to try and do something good and really broke the mold. And when he broke that mold, we are now looking at that mold being applied to every other situation that we have.
That is the Marshall Plan mold. The phrase always comes up. Jack Beattie, Hollywood, of course, makes things personal, but no matter how personal, and maybe particularly when they're made personal, there are politics woven through every single film that looks at war's aftermath.
Oh, indeed, and there are politics in the certainly of the Marshall Plan. I mean, it helped revive our economy by reviving the European economy, and it helped in the containment of Russia. Nevertheless, Winston Churchill called it the most unsordid act in the history of nations, and he described Europe then in 1947 in words that suitably adapted could fit Iraq today. Churchill said, "Europe was a rubble heap, a charnel house, a breeding ground of pestilence and hate." And the Marshall Plan, which in its $13 billion, equivalent to about the $100 billion we'll wind up spending on Iraq, was our answer to it. And when Secretary Marshall introduced it at Harvard's commencement, here's what he said. He said, "Our policy is directed not against any country, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos."
Of course, in Iraq, we have this new situation, very unlike World War II. Iraq, writ large, was not the enemy. And so we have this strange dynamic. It's playing out this week, and you can see the tension of it, the pressure of it. It's even led to U.S. soldiers firing on Iraqi civilians in mobs in Mosul, this is not a situation where the whole country is supposed to sit down and listen. We're telling the country to stand up and say what they want. This is new terrain in many ways, Jack.
Yes, and we may not like what they tell us. I mean, they may not want to do what we want them to do. But, you know, that's politics. And I think the people in the Bush administration who plead politics, he says, this is liberty, have a point. It's not going to be clean. It's not going to be neat. But let's hope to justify this suffering that it's better than what they knew under Saddam.
Well, and it comes with an awful lot of responsibility, maybe more responsibility than we've been able to exhibit this last week as ancient treasures of Mesopotamia, of the whole world, were destroyed there, along with an awful lot of people's lives. Garen Daly, the first film you've got on your list here is from an American experience where there was an awful lot of destruction in the name of war goals, Gone with the Wind. Everybody knows it, both the book and the movie. Set up what you're excerpting here for us. Why this? What are we going to hear?
All right, what we're going to hear is a very small scene in the movie. It's after the South is lost. They're a defeated country. Vivian Leigh, who plays Scarlett O'Hara, has gone to see Rhett Butler, who's in jail, trying to raise money to save Tarek for back taxes. She gets spurned by Rhett because he has no money. She's walking down the streets of Atlanta, and what we're going to hear is
that famous green dress made of the curtains.
That's right, exactly. And what we're hearing is that what's going on in the street. And if you listen closely, you'll see the underlying tones of a race of people who are trying to be uplifted but who may not be ready, and people taking advantage of them. This is Scarlett O'Hara walking down the streets in Atlanta in 1865 after the war.
You know what we're going to do?
What?
We're going to give every last one of you 40 acres and a mule.
And a mule?
40 acres and a mule.
Gee! Because we're your friends.
And you're going to become voters. And you're going to vote like your friends do.
So there they are, the promises of the aftermath of war in the South. And I guess what we hear is sounds like some kind of northern emissary, nay, carpetbagger, talking with black Southerners after the war, 40 acres and a mule for everybody. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. And you notice in the movie, though, the response is kind of, the people are not really there. They're not sharply going, oh, yeah, that's great. There's an underlying racism here. And that is something that is not talked about a lot in this movie. And I think that if we look at what we're trying to do with Iraq as well, you know, are they ready for democracy, as your last segment was talking about? And I think we can make a parallel between what was shown in Gone with the Wind and what is going on in Iraq right now.
Well, and also, though, of what attitudes Americans bring to this whole project and whether they're really respectful of the people in the country that has just been liberated. Jack Beatty, what do you hear in this little clip out of the great saga of Gone with the Wind?
Well, first of all, there never were 40 acres. There was no mule. Mm-hmm. That was the great failure of Reconstruction. The dilemma that faced the radical Republicans after the war was essentially this. If we give them 40 acres and a mule, what do we do about inequality for white people? And, of course, that argument has bedeviled black progress in this country for a long time.
You mean
since.
How can we give it to former slaves and not
to
the poor white guy next door?
How can we give it to former slaves and not to poor white guy next door? And that is effectively what killed the 40 acres and mule, that and the prevailing racism. But this movie, Walter White, the secretary of the NAACP, said whatever sentiment for federal anti-lynching laws evaporated during the Gone with the Wind vogue.
Because
this was a picture, this was an idyllic, a romantic, racist picture of the South, the old South, gentility, loyal slaves, devoted to their white masters. A picture as at variance with reality as the imagination of the woman who wrote it, Margaret Mitchell. To be sure, David Selznick cleaned it up a good deal. In the novel, Ashley Wilkes and Scarlett O'Hara's husband, Frank Kennedy, are leaders in the KKK, and they go on a murder raid against blacks. Selznick didn't show that. And Selznick also didn't depict the federal troops as grave robbers as they are depicted in the novel. Nevertheless, the novel had a very pernicious effect in its depiction of Reconstruction, of slavery, and of the idea that, well, the central notion in it really is the one that W.E.B. Du Bois, in his book on Black Reconstruction, published at the same time, said one fact and one fact alone explains the attitude of most recent writers toward Reconstruction. They cannot conceive of Negroes as men.
But something interesting there in what you say from the book, not the movie, about the KKK riding through Gone with the Wind. One can easily imagine all kinds of subterranean resistance to the United States in Iraq developing very quickly here. In fact, we may already be seeing it.
Oh, we are, I think. I mean, there'll be gangs against us. There'll be Kurds against Arabs. There'll be Shiites, and there'll be secret cells. Inevitably, we're going to hear a lot of this sort of low-intensity conflict from here on in. That's what the Ku Klux. That's what federal troops faced in the South with the Ku Klux Klan. Low-intensity conflict.
Jack, D.W. Griffith did it in Birth of a Nation when he did show how the KKK was formed as a way of beating back those troops and to become a guerrilla warfare. As Nathan Bedford Forrest, I believe, created the KKK, and he was a great guerrilla fighter and a great guerrilla general. And I think we're going to see the same kind of thing where those Iraqi troops that melted away into the civilization, into the civilian life, are going to come back together and become guerrilla fighters.
Garen, take us up to World War II. Of course, all kinds of movies about the aftermath of that war, the romantic setting, but of a destroyed Europe. You've got a clip here from The Third Man. Set this up for us.
All right. The Third Man is directed by Carol Reed. It's 1949. It's a wonderful film. Stars Orson Welles as Harry Lime. Harry Lime is a black marketeer taking advantage of the political situation, the power vacuum that existed in Vienna in post-World War II.
What's he selling?
What's he selling is diluted penicillin.
That's pretty low.
That is low. That is low. And what he's doing is he's taking advantage of the four powers in Vienna because they cooperated. Rather than the U.S. controlling everything like they're doing in Iraq right now, they divided between the Russians, the English, the French, because we were nice, and ourselves. And in this scene, Harry Lime's best friend, played by Joseph Cotten, is talking to Trevor Howard about what they can do to capture this really bad guy.
But look here, Martins, you can always arrange to meet him at some little cafe here in the international zone.
Wouldn't work.
We'll never get him in the Russian zone.
Calloway, you expect too much. Oh, I know he deserves to hang. You've proved your stuff, but 20 years is a long time. Don't ask me to tie the rope.
Okay, forget it.
Busy, Major?
What is it, Blonsky?
We have identified the girl. Here is her report.
I've questioned her. We've got nothing against her.
We shall apply for her at the four-power meeting tomorrow. She has no right to be here.
I've asked your people to help with Lime.
That's a different case. It is being looked into. So long, Major.
In the last war, a general would hang his opponent's picture on the wall. He got to know him that way.
The Third Man, 1949, and here we are, Garen Daly, in the exploitation, the moral murk, the carpetbagging of a post-war scene.
Yeah, and, you know, what's interesting about all of this is that just prior to the scene, the most famous quote that come out of The Third Man was stated, and that is Harry Lime talking to his friend Joseph Cotten, saying, after, you know, generations of the Borgias, look what happened in Italy. You got Michelangelo and the Renaissance. And in Switzerland, you had 200 years of democracy, and look what you got, the cuckoo clock. And you wonder sometimes whether the upheaval of the cultural society might bring forth something a little more valuable than a cuckoo clock.
Jack Beatty, Third Man?
Well, it's a great movie, and it's one of its features is its setting. It was actually filmed in blasted Vienna. And the physical destruction mirrors and echoes the moral one. You see that when people are desperate, they do anything to survive. And, of course, in Iraq, that is happening every single day. People do anything to survive. Pillage, loot, you name it, and they're going to do it.
And the moral temptations that are always there in that turmoil after a war. Here we've got a guy selling diluted penicillin just because they need it, and he doesn't have to sell it full strength.
Yes, profiteering this time on misery, but the general picture of the profiteer, we haven't seen the last of that figure, I'm afraid.
We're talking tonight about Hollywood and post-war reconstruction, physical, personal, and spiritual. You can join the conversation. What are your favorite post-war aftermath movies? Which one speaks to you and to the situations, the reconstruction challenges now facing Iraq and America? What's the bigger post-war challenge, the physical or the spiritual, the psychological? And what will Hollywood's storyline ultimately be for this war, for this aftermath? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hollywood and post-war reconstruction, physical, personal, and spiritual. I'm joined by Garen Daly, our On Point movie maven and artistic director at the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and by Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst. You can join the conversation as well. What are your favorite post-war aftermath movies? Which ones speak to you and to the situation, the reconstruction challenges now facing Iraq and America? Do you hear how these films insist that we remember the price of war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack, I wanted to put to you this question about what Hollywood's goal tends to be in movies about the aftermath of war. Is it truth? Is it legend? Is it whitewash? Does it depend on the war?
I think it does depend on the war. I mean, the movies in the aftermath of the Vietnam War were sulfuric in general about Vietnam and about the fact that so many young Americans lost their lives in this tragic and hopeless and stupid war. Which we, you know, not an American has suffered since. No dominoes have fallen. But the movies right after World War II don't call into question the justice of the war. What they do is they talk about the price, the psychological price in a movie like The Men with Marlon Brando about psychiatric cases, even a movie like 12 O'Clock High. And of course, The Best Years of Our Lives, about the problems of adjusting to civilian life after the war.
And of course, they talk about judgment, and nowhere more explicitly than in Judgment at Nuremberg, Garen Daly.
Yeah, Judgment at Nuremberg really is the touchstone for Hollywood looking at what we should be doing as a nation when it comes to war crimes. And in Judgment Nuremberg, which is produced by Stanley Kramer, directed by Stanley Kramer, it stars Spencer Tracy as a tribunal judge in Nuremberg weighing the decision on four Nazi German judges and whether they were complicit in the murder and sterilization of people.
And this is years later, a 1961 movie.
1961 movie. But I think when you look at it as 1961, we really have to say this is America pushing forth an idea that you are going to be held accountable, that there are war crimes and that there are crimes against humanity. And this trial, you know, Judgment at Nuremberg, really points it out. And what's nice is we're
an idea that, by the way, is as fresh as Pentagon statements of the last 10 days on individuals in Iraq and the famous pack of cards.
Right. And in this scene, we're going to listen to Spencer Tracy doing the final verdict. Now, what you're not going to be able to see in this is that Burt Lancaster is the man that he's talking to. Burt Lancaster plays a German judge who thought he was doing the right thing. He was trying to balance out what was good for the country and what he had to do to survive. This is Spencer Tracy.
This trial has shown that under a national crisis, ordinary, even able and extraordinary men can delude themselves into the commission of crimes so vast and heinous that they beggar the imagination. No one who has sat through the trial can ever forget them. Men sterilized because of political belief, a mockery made of friendship and faith, the murder of children. How easily it can happen. There are those in our own country, too, who today speak of the protection of country, of survival. A decision must be made in the life of every nation at the very moment when the grasp of the enemy is at its throat. Then it seems that the only way to survive is to use the means of the enemy, to rest survival upon what is expedient, to look the other way. Well, the answer to that is survival as what? A country isn't a rock. It's not an extension of oneself. It's what it stands for. It's what it stands for when standing for something is the most difficult. Before the people of the world, let it now be noted that here in our decision, this is what we stand for. Justice, truth, and the value of a single human being.
Judgment at Nuremberg, 1971. Jack Beatty, a lot of politics here, a lot of text and subtext.
Yes, Stalin's solution to the post-war problems, he said that Tehran, he said, we should shoot 50,000 German officers. Henry Morgenthau, President Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury, wanted to turn Germany into a pastoral society to protect it. And FDR, at one droll moment at Yalta, suggested taking the plumbing out of all German houses as punishment. Instead, there was the tribunal at Nuremberg that hung 12 people and the prosecutions of hundreds of thousands of others. If I may, I'd like to actually read from the opening statement of the real judge there, Justice Robert H. Jackson. He said, "In the prisoner's dock sit 20-odd broken men, reproached by the humiliation of those they have led almost as bitterly as by the desolation of those they have attacked. Their personal capacity for evil is forever past. It is hard now to perceive in these miserable men as captives the power by which, as Nazi leaders, they once dominated much of the world and terrified most of it. What makes this inquest significant is that these prisoners represent sinister influences that will lurk in the world long after their bodies have returned to dust." Justice Jackson at the Nuremberg trial.
Of course, Jack, most of the 55 faces on the U.S. military's pack of cards in Iraq are still missing, and one wonders what the environment will be when and if they are brought to trial, if there'll be the same universal denunciation, the same sort of righteous wrath, or whether it gets caught up in a kind of intercultural engagement where... Are Iraqis going to celebrate these judgments or not?
One doesn't know, but I think the U.S. is making a serious mistake in saying that we're going to try these in our own sort of military tribunals and not before the International Court of International Courts, because, of course, the legitimacy question, which is dogging everything we do in Iraq, will come up then again most pointedly.
Bob's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, from Natick. Good evening.
Good evening.
Great show. I was thinking about this topic the other day, as a matter of fact, and I was thinking about the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
Sure.
And that scene, and I wanted to rent the movie, but it was out. I think, I wonder if somebody else had the same idea.
But I suppose you must be thinking of the scene where after they've taken over the great capital and all the sheikhs sit in the great hall, but there's no electricity, the British keep it off, and people are stomping around on tables, and it's represented as quickly turning into kind of anarchy and futility.
Anarchy and futility, and Lawrence, I believe, after that gets up and goes over to the hospital and finds himself hopelessly unable to deal with the misery and the suffering around him.
Garen Daly, there's an example that Bob brings up of how the kind of puppet strings of the great power are still at work even after the goal of victory has been won by Arabs in Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, in Lawrence of Arabia, that becomes really one of the main themes in it. Even at the ending, we still see that same kind of, you know, strings being pulled. And what we lose when that happens is that the people who have been oppressed, the people we're supposedly liberating in Iraq, are never going to get the chance to get their own reconciliation with their government. And I think that if we end up, you know, trying these 56 odd people without having some sort of truth and reconciliation for the Iraqi people, they will never be ready to assume the control and power. They need to be the ones that make the decision about their former leaders.
And of course, so far, Jack, in Iraq, you have a little bit of a chilly echo of this thing, where you have Iraqis, including potential future leaders, in cities without water, in cities without electricity. I'm sure everyone's trying to get it there, but they are right now left without means.
They are, and you have the imperial power, which has other priorities. In World War I, it was the priority of essentially putting a squeeze on these people and recognizing you're Arabs. You can't manage your own affairs. You need Englishmen for that. And here, I think we're trying to manipulate things so that it'll benefit the parties that we want to come out on top. And the electricity has not been among our high priorities.
Bob, thanks for your call. Garen, you or Jack earlier talked about The Best Years of Our Lives, a 1946 film, big film. Describe it for us.
All right. It's an Oscar-winning film. It's a story about three separate young men coming back from World War II, an Army guy, a Navy guy, an Air Force guy, and they actually live in the same Midwestern city, and they become friends on the route back to their home. Mm-hmm. It's a story about them trying to rebuild their lives. Now, this is, again, 1946 when the film was coming out, so it's very, very hopeful. But they run into problems. Harold Russell, who is one of the stars, wins an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor, was actually a disabled veteran. And then there's Dana Andy.
Who had lost his hand?
Both of his hands. In the Navy.
In the Navy, World War II.
And sadly, he ended up having to sell his Oscar to pay for his wife's medical bills.
Much later in his life.
But, I mean, it was an inspiring story, and even in the end with him being able to do that for his wife, I thought was also inspiring. But, you know, they do run into problems. They're trying to rebuild their lives. It wasn't the same as when they left. And here's an example where Dana Andrews has found out that his wife is a floozy and playing him for a sucker, and so it's time for him to make a decision.
You forgot these, huh?
Oh, I don't want them, Pop.
What are they?
Just a lot of fancy words that don't mean anything. You can throw them away.
Say, these are citations for your medals.
Why, Freddie, you never showed them to us.
Those things came in the packages of K-rations.
Well, we'll treasure them, my boy. Think you're doing the right thing, son?
You mean going? Who's to say in advance whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing? It just means a fresh start in some other place.
How do you know it'll be different anyplace else? There's a need here for fellas like yourself that fought and won the war.
Hmm.
I know you haven't had the best of breaks since you got back, but, well, seems like you ought to stick here and slug it out a while longer on your own home grounds.
You're all right, Pop. But I know when it's time to bail out. I gotta get going.
The best years of our lives, 1946, Jack Beatty. War throws a wrench into many lives. People have losses. They make decisions. A man loses his hands. A woman decides to have lovers other than her husband, who's over there. And then they come back and try and rebuild, and it's not just a golden sunrise.
No, it's not. And this is, I think, one of the greatest of Hollywood movies. That scene goes on to have the father, who's clearly a man who's struggled in life, sitting down and reading aloud these citations about his son, and his voice cracks as he hears Captain So-and-so, his own name, the man's own name, who did this, Captain So-and-so did that. And he squares his shoulder and takes off his glasses and sort of looks away. It's a beautiful moment, and the film is full of them. And what they are, they're moments of remembering the honor and the sacrifice and the camaraderie that propel these men in war. And then here they are in the quotidian, you know, civilian life. Mm-hmm. Poor Dana Andrews has to work at a drugstore making sodas. Mm-hmm. Tough come down.
And on both sides, I mean, war by definition, it creates a new sort of playing board. But there's a lot of blood and a lot of loss involved in it. Whether you went over there and came back home or whether you're in the battle zone, as Iraqis are, yes, there may be a new day, but gosh, there's a lot of blood under the floor, Ghirardelli.
There is a lot of blood under the floor, but the thing that you have to remember about the best years of our life is this is the ultimate Hollywood film because at the end, everyone is happy. All three men find a form of happiness so that they can move on and their life has been slightly rebuilt. And that is very, very positive. And Hollywood in 1946 had to say that to everyone coming out of the
services. Well, they were actually tough years after World War II.
They were tough.
So maybe that was their gift of hope. Sam's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Very nice show. Very interesting. I'm going to bring up a movie that may not come first to mind. It's coming quite far back to ancient times. It's Spartacus.
Spartacus, sure.
My favorite movie is with
Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas, of course. And, you know, what I've always thought about movies, and I think it's very important, is that when you have a post-war situation, you get a much more realistic situation of the society than you would under the repression or under the auspices of wartime.
More realistic post-war. What do you mean by that, Sam?
I mean, in my opinion, after Gladiator, Spartacus best epitomizes the depravity of the Roman Empire. You know, it was after the Second Punic War, I believe, and depicted the slave revolt. I can't remember the exact date. And I think if you really want to look at the Roman culture, Spartacus captures it, at least from what I've read, much, much better than any other movie. And I think that's it's one of the things in the chaos of war, of post-war, that is unique about post-war. And I think Iraq is the same.
Sam is a great point. I want to put it to Jack. You know, Jack, we sort of look forward to 10, 15, 20, 30 years out with a little bit of trembling to what an Iraqi film industry may one day make of the American intervention there. We hope it's good, but we hope it's not Spartacus.
Yeah, we certainly, right, not unless we're Spartacus or we're the people. You know, I think we may well come out as the Parisian, whoever they're called. I don't know, there's some pirates in there who are supposed to help Spartacus. And, you know, they take his money and they take the treasure and they don't deliver. So maybe we'll be depicted as the version of those pirates. But, you know, this what Sam brought up, this picture of Rome, I mean, that movie shows one of the dangers of imperialism, which is that to protect Rome, the legions have to come back into the city. And they're protecting Rome because Rome is going around starting trouble abroad. Yeah. And when they come back into the city, there goes the Republic.
More trouble. Ghirardelli, real quick before the break, we've got, of course, after Vietnam, many, many, many films. You've chosen to listen to a little bit of First Blood, where Rambo came from.
Well, Rambo, I think, is one of the great cultural icons of the 70s and 80s, and I think you can still see it when you have Iraqi dissidents talking about America's not Rambo. But Rambo was a troubled post-traumatic stress syndrome man who did not find a home, did not find that father, and he was struggling all the time.
It's over, Johnny. It's over!
Nothing is over! Nothing! You just don't turn it off! It wasn't my war! You asked me, I didn't ask you! And I did what I had to do to win, but somebody wouldn't let us win! And I come back to the world, and I see all those maggots at the airport, protesting me, spitting, calling me baby killer and all kinds of vile crap! Who are they to protest me, huh? Who are they? Unless they've been me and been there and know what the hell they're yelling about!
It was a bad time for everyone, Rambo. It's all in the past now.
For you! For me, civilian life is nothing. In the field, we had a code of honor. You watch my back, I watch yours. Back here, there's nothing.
You're the last of an elite group. Don't end it like this.
Back there, I can fly a gunship. I can drive a tank. I was in charge of million-dollar equipment. Back here, I can't even hold a job.
Rambo's debut, Sylvester Stallone in 1982 with First Blood. And Jack Beatty, whatever else comes home, there is passion and fury in war that cannot help but come back in the backpack, even in the kind of over-the-top Rambo presentation.
Yeah, nothing is over, he said. You just don't turn it off. Of course, that movie punctuates what apparently is a myth, the spitting at airports. I've read recently there's no documented incidents of that. Nevertheless, the Vietnam veterans were treated shamefully. And what this reminds me of course, just listening to the price that this man had to pay, was the priceless comment of our vice president when he was asked why he didn't serve in Vietnam, why, in fact, he got five different deferments. He said, quote, "I had other priorities."
Dick Cheney, on the record. We're talking tonight about Hollywood and post-war reconstruction. You can join the conversation. Does Hollywood whitewash the aftermath of war? Does it revise history? Or does it remind us what war and its aftermath are? Can you hear how Hollywood struggles to confront history, to bend history? And will the Iraq story be told straight? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm joined tonight by our movie maven Ghirardelli and our news analyst Jack Beatty. We're looking at Hollywood and post-war reconstruction, looking for some perspective on the new phase of the war in Iraq, the aftermath phase. Hollywood has looked at a lot of wars, and Ghirardelli, they've looked, in fact, at post-war, immediate post-war aftermath in Iraq, not so long ago.
Yep, what I consider a new cult classic, David O. Russell's Three Kings with George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, and Ice Cube.
Terrific film.
The terrific film. These guys are in trouble, they need help, and they go right to some Iraqi freedom fighters and try to give them that good old American rah-rah-rah to get them going.
What's so funny?
Cannot take.
What you mean, cannot take? Kick Saddam's ass, we definitely take.
We are the United States Army.
You are three guys with a bunch of civilians and no Humvee.
Need money. Have no money to eat, to live. When to just come kill them,
the American Army is huge. It has planes and tanks, and we have nothing.
Listen to me. We will rise up together. Tell him.
Endorsu.
Rise up.
Endorsu.
Look at us. Many races. Many nations.
Torso.
Working together.
Not Melsu.
Tell him, Chief.
Yes, we're united.
United.
Metahdin.
George Bush. George Bush wants you.
You. You. Stand up for yourself.
George Bush yahtajkum.
George Bush
wants you.
You
wants you.
Yes.
He wants everybody.
George he wants
Bush.
All yes. of you. You stand up together. Fight. Kick the down there.
George Bush wants you.
Yes.
He wants you.
Yes.
Mekadin.
He wants you. Maybe you can fight for freedom on your own. And America will follow. God bless America. And God bless a free Iraq.
Three Kings, 1991. It's set in the first Gulf War, and these American soldiers, fresh across the border into Iraq, are nothing like the high-minded freedom fighters that they present themselves at. They're looking for booty. They're looking for gold. And it's a kind of moral free fire zone here, Ghirardelli.
Well, actually, at this stage of the film, they've already got their booty. They've got the gold bullion. They're looking for a way out, and they're trying to get the Iraqis to give them a hand. And what they're doing is they're trading off on their freedom, the fact that they've just been liberated and that they are the liberators, and they're going to be taking advantage of not only their gold, but also their goodwill and their transportation.
An awful lot of temptation to cynical exploitation after a war, Jack.
Yes, and of course, this refers to the playing up of George Bush saying, you know, join us, rise up. This is one of the most shameful episodes of the sort of the coda of the Gulf War, when President Bush did, in fact, call for Shiites and Kurds to rise up. When they rose up, we did not protect them. They were slaughtered in their thousands. And to this day, that remains one of our main problems in, quote, liberating Iraq. But, you know, this business of treasure. Today's Wall Street Journal had a piece about the treasure from the first Gulf War, the billion or so, several billion dollars impounded by President Bush recently. Mm. Veterans groups have been suing in courts to get that money for having been tortured and so on. And the president isn't going to let them get it. Instead, it's going to go to fund Bechtel and the other corporations that are going to rebuild Iraq.
Well, that is rebuilding. Dave is calling from Wanaki, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I'm wondering if we're going to get the Hollywood version of the rescue of Private Lynch.
Jessica Lynch. Is that inevitable or what?
That'll be a made-for-TV movie.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, what I've read about in the Times is that the Iraqis tried to... The doctor sent her in an ambulance to try and turn them over to the American troops, and the ambulance driver got shot at, so he had to go back to the hospital. They took her and put her in a room. They were treating her wounds and everything, and the American forces came in guns a-blazing. There was no resistance to them. They pretty much shot up the hospital and finally got to Private Lynch, but... it was just an utter fiasco.
Well, it's funny. It's funny. There's so many versions of that story out there already. That's not the one I've heard. But, Jack, when this gets to Hollywood, and thanks for raising it, Dave, how do you think this story is going to be presented?
Well, the first Gulf War was the one picture we have is an accurate one. I think, for all the rollicking roguery of these guys, they're thieves. They're ripping off the Iraqis, and they're exploiting them. They're dying to get these guys their treasure.
But Jessica Lynch, the damsel
rescued from the clutches
of the evil.
She is going to be immortalized. I mean, of course, now it comes out that she really wasn't wounded. It comes out that she may not really have engaged in a firefight. Nevertheless, she's going to be the Sergeant York of this movie, and the whole machinery of American sentimentalism is just going to make her our icon.
Garen, at what point do you think that the Hollywood perspective on a particular war gets set? Is it set already, days after the end of the big shooting in Iraq, or does it Hollywood wait to see how the movie settles in? Is it nervous about how it presents the war, or does it just charge ahead with either a heroic or a satirical or even cynical or critical view of war?
Right now, Hollywood is so terrified of Washington, and they're terrified of doing anything that's unpatriotic, that any depiction of Jessica Lynch or the Gulf War II is going to be very patriotic and very done in a light that is going to be pleasing to Washington. It'll be some time before we get something that's a little more critical, and it may be a film coming out of Iraq in 5-6 years that shows it in a different light. A lot will depend on when we get out of there and whether or not we destroy their culture.
Jack, just a few seconds, but is that true to history also? Red, white, and blue right after the war, something more complex later?
I think that's right. I think that's right, with Vietnam as the possible one exception. World War One too. Right after the Great War, there were just some plays of disillusion basically saying this was all done for war profiteers, so that that era's version of contractors could make money.
The difference, though, is right now the big media companies are controlling Hollywood, and they are listening very much to what Washington's saying.
Ghirardelli, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, as always.
Jack, hang on for just a few minutes. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
In Iraq, the regime of Saddam Hussein is no more. Our victory in Iraq is certain, but it is not complete.
We are concerned about Syria's development of these kinds of weapons. We are concerned about Syria's continuing support of terrorist organizations. And in recent weeks, we have been concerned about the flow of material across the Syrian border into Iraq, as well as the flow of individuals back and forth across the Syrian-Iraq border.
We think the focus at the moment is the search for WMD in Iraq. Secondly, we're concerned about Syria's own WMD. And obviously, if a council member or any member of the United Nations proposes a resolution for consideration, we're prepared to consider it. That doesn't mean we're prepared to adopt it, embrace it, or endorse it.
We saw the role of Barzani Ibrahim Hassan al-Tikriti as an advisor to former President Saddam Hussein. We believe that he is an insider, and in terms of priorities, about 38 on our list of 55 top individuals that we believe have key information about the regime.
On behalf of my fellow soldiers, I'd like to take a brief moment to let everyone know that we're receiving outstanding medical care. And I'd like to thank all my fellow Americans. We all would like to thank our Americans for the tremendous support we've been getting. And we're looking forward to coming home as soon as we possibly can.
We will lay out clearly the concerns we have with respect to their nuclear weapons development programs and other weapons of mass destruction, their proliferation activities, missile programs, and all of the other issues that I think they are familiar with. This is good news for the region. It is good news for North Korea, frankly.
And there's a week President Bush announces that victory in Iraq is certain but not complete. Colin Powell and others issue stern warnings to Syria, signaling Damascus to get in line with U.S. goals. Syria responds by proposing a U.N. resolution that would declare the Middle East a weapons of mass destruction free zone. This would apply to Israel's nuclear weapons as well. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, downplayed the idea. General Vincent Brooks announces the capture of Saddam Hussein's half-brother, one of the former leaders depicted on the most wanted deck of playing cards. 7 American POWs are rescued over the weekend. Chief Warrant Officer David S. Williams, an Apache helicopter pilot, spoke for the group there, saying they are looking forward to coming home. And North Korean leaders agree to meet with U.S. and Chinese officials in Beijing next week. Jack Beatty, there we are, turning yet again, this time out of the full fury of war and into something much more complicated.
Yes, and for me, the metaphor of the week was exhumation, things coming to light. I mean, it ends with the guy we thought was murdered, which was killed last week, Saddam, in a video shot last week, which was the week after, which was the day that we were liberating Iraq.
Maybe.
But there he is. He lives again. It was also, of course, the week we learned about that the treasures exhumed from years of excavation in Iraq, the treasures of civilization had been looted by the Iraqis. Just a terrible story. And, of course, one that reflects quite gravely, I think, on the United States. President Bush was warned about this. Secretary Rumsfeld was warned about this by museum people. They said you had to get people there. That had to be done. And Rumsfeld, at his press conference, just pretended he had never heard anything like that in his life. And, by the way, something about Rumsfeld came out this week, a letter pointing pointing out that when he went to visit Saddam Hussein for Reagan in 1983, he also did a little business on the side and suggested that maybe Bechtel could build a pipeline through Iraq to someplace else. So that's a little embarrassment for the secretary.
Jack, I can feel a kind of pause this week. I mean, it was a week ago we were looking at a war that many had been afraid for a few days was going to go poorly, that ended up going well in military terms, and Baghdad had fallen, the statue came down, and Americans were feeling like, all right, we've done it. And this week, the realization growing with every passing day that there is no sharp, clear end to this, that the reconstruction could be very, very long and very complicated, and the United States will not necessarily be thanked for it in any kind of fashion that it might long for.
No, one of the things being dug up clearly are the feuds, the tribal feuds, ethnic feuds, religious feuds that Saddam, as president, as dictator, was sitting atop. And of course, the model is Yugoslavia, where Tito sat atop that country for 50 years, keeping all those ethnic and divisions down, and then he left, and they emerged. And boy, you can just see them now: Arab versus Kurds in the north, Shiites, Sunnis. Even within the Shiites, one faction against another, murders in the cathedral already or the mosque. Mm. A messy, messy situation.
But a real conversation this week about what is the sort of, and I hate to say it, but kind of normal post-war disorder. Donald Rumsfeld effectively referring to all this as the sort of normal untidiness of the aftermath of war. That seemed really extreme. But people trying to think through, is this typical? Is this, can this still bode well? Or do we see here in the Oracle bones and in this early chaos some really frightening indications of what may come?
I'm frightened, and I think we all should be, about how long we're going to stay there and about how much trouble we're going to have. Trouble that we didn't necessarily cause. But, you know, everything that goes wrong now is going to be blamed on us, and so many things are going wrong. And this is where, you know, we mentioned this last week, this is where the lack of, the understaffing of this war, the lack of the 4th Division, this is where it's really coming up. I mean, to protect civilians, protect these places, we didn't have the troops to do it. But, you know, what hasn't been uncovered, of course, are the weapons of mass destruction, and that looms over all of this, doesn't it?
The primary justification for the war, and at this moment, not yet found, they may still be, but with each passing day, that gets more uncomfortable, I think, for everyone who's watching this.
It has to. I mean, President Bush made statements. Vice President Cheney said on Meet the Press, Saddam has reconstituted his nuclear weapons. Now if he could be in the position that President Eisenhower was at, really, in 1960, when he said, we don't send spy planes over the Soviet Union when one was just shot down. Our government leaders should not use their credibility and the United States' credibility saying things that aren't so. And these people are going to have a lot to answer for if we have an opposition party that about their claims about what Iraq had. What were your intelligence sources? People are going to want to know. And there are going to be leaks aplenty from the CIA about the Rumsfeld. Remember, Rumsfeld had his own intelligence group. Maybe they were cooking some of these estimates. We're going to, the night of the long knives are going to be out in Washington over this whole issue.
And the test is in the big turn. The military phase went with passing ease in relative terms. Now we'll see what the United States can bring to the very long and much more complicated aftermath of war. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Have a good weekend.
And you too. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.